Hey there, Mystic Theurges.
Welcome to another Flashlight.
This week, we'll be talking about the dawn of Dungeons & Dragons.
Let's roll initiative. So in our last Flashlight, we talked about kind of like the pre-D&D tabletop role-playing game era. And this week, we're going to be talking a bit about the development of like the very first versions of Dungeons & Dragons at a company called TSR, or Tactical Studies Rules. This is based in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. It was run by Gary Gygax, famously, but it also involved Dave Arneson and some of the other people who were involved in those early war games we talked about last time.
Ooh.
Yeah. And this is a period of game development that has a ton of documentaries, podcasts, kind of like, again, there's a whole hagiography going on here. And on these flashlights, we're not really focusing on like building up that pantheon of the great men in the history of tabletop gaming. But this is an important era, and a lot of the decisions made in these really early editions of D&D in like the early to mid-1970s have bled through into a lot of fantasy tabletop gaming since, right? Things were being done in this era kind of ad hoc, and they worked out well as gameplay decisions. They made these games fun, and then subsequent game designers have just followed and adopted a lot of them. So I think it's worth talking about a couple of those in particular. All the different dice that we use when we play tabletop role-playing games, and how you know, TSR started to incorporate a bunch of different types of dice, and also just the weird and cool monsters that just show up in every edition of Dungeons & Dragons over and over. So let's start talking about the dice. Just so we're on the same page, why do we actually use different types of dice? Like, when you think of it, 3d4... 2d6, 1d12, those all give you numbers up to 12, right?
Yes.
So why do we not just, like, why do we use these different dice to get combinations that could add up to 12?
You know what, Jake? I've actually never thought about that. High level.
Yeah.
Is it impractical to roll a handful of dice for every move?
In my opinion, it can get pretty impractical, but people love rolling dice. And as we'll see in a little bit, in these early Dungeons & Dragons editions, they loved rolling dice to a degree that was perhaps unreasonable. So they were not trying to limit the number of dice they rolled.
Okay. With one die for each foot, one foot in front of the other.
Pretty much.
This journey begins.
If you recall, we tried to play a little bit of very old Dungeons & Dragons editions last season in a flashlight, and we encountered a lot of dice rolls for like the characteristics of a horse.
Yeah.
But so the reason that you might think that we use different numbers of dice, even if they all like add up to 12 or something, is like the distribution, or like the amount of chaos, right?
Chaos on the table, or chaos
in the outcomes?
Okay.
If you roll 3d4, right?
Yeah.
You're going to get a middling roll, like 6, 7, 8, or 9, more than 2/3 of the time.
Wait, really? Statistically, that's different?
Yeah. Because the only way that... So if you roll 1d12, there's just a 1 in 12 chance that you get a 12, of course.
Right, flat 1/12
chance. If you roll 3d4s, the only way you can get 12 is if they all land on the 4. Right, and so there's a 1 in 64 chance of that happening. Right, because you have to get a quarter times a quarter times a quarter. You have to have each one land on the 4 to get 12.
Right.
And so when you're rolling like a bunch of small dice, like that don't go up that high, the outcomes are like crushed in towards the center.
Okay.
You're more likely to get middling rolls.
Right.
And so for storytelling purposes,
we don't want to be leaning towards the average all the time.
Right. And so some abilities you might have are chaotic. And then you roll a d12 and it's like, you could get a 1, you could get a 12. You're usually not going to get like a middle of the curve roll. Whereas with 3d4, you're usually going to get middle.
And you literally can't get a 1. You can't get below a 3.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a lot safer. But it's also a lot less likely you'll get the really good rolls.
Right.
So you're exactly getting it. And that's what makes it, like, you know, for storytelling purposes, there's a difference between these really, like, kind of reliable type abilities versus a more chaotic one, right? And you can build that in by changing what dice people are rolling. And like, hey, these distributions really collapse. It is incredible to me, just between us. I'm assuming no one else is listening. It's incredible to me how many times in an actual play, someone will roll like 8d6 for fireball, and they'll get a number above 40. Because that can happen, mathematically speaking, but it's going to happen less than 1% of the time on average, right? Because once you have 8d6, that's a lot of dice.
Yeah.
The rolls are really skewed towards a middling outcome, yeah. Right?
Are you saying there's a little bit of movie magic in these actual plays?
Huge if true.
Are they not actually playing?
I think they are actually playing. I think sometimes for these big handfuls of dice, they maybe go with a cinematic number. Because when you roll 8d6, you shouldn't get 40 plus that often. Like when you roll a big handful of dice, usually, almost always, you're going to be in just kind of a middling roll. Because to get a really high roll, you need to, the probability gets really low that you're going to roll all fives and six on eight dice, right? Mm-hmm. The probability of rolling all fives or sixes on eight dice is, oh no, 1 in 6,400 or thereabouts.
Jake, so, the human calculator over here.
I think that's right. Hey, if you're...
I'm not checking your math.
Thank you. And of course, no one at home is either, so we're set. But yeah, there's like a big trade-off here, right? Having all these different dice, it's like satisfying to roll the different... The shapes are nice. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the way that the dice shapes are duals of each other, right? And like if you connect the midpoints of all the faces of a d6, mm-hmm. you get a d8. And if you connect the midpoints of all the faces of a d12, you get a d20.
Oh, we're talking geometry
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I love it. It's so satisfying. Wow. You connect the midpoints of all the faces of a d4, you get a d4.
Okay.
I love that kind of thing. It's very, they're satisfying little shapes, right?
Right.
And you can get all these different levels of chaos by changing what dice people are rolling. But d6s, everyone has them.
Mm-hmm.
You have them in like... In your home?
Yeah, they're just around.
They're around. They're easy to make because they're cubes.
Yeah.
Cube stack.
Cube stack. You're not packing air.
I don't know how we manufacture dice. I'm assuming the cube shape is a little bit easier than D20s, right? So the trade-off is like once you start having all these dice that aren't D6s, it gets harder to find them and they're more specialty items. And actually, later this season, we're going to be talking to someone about a game from Japan where almost all games do just use D6s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it is much harder to find all these specialty dice shapes. And so game developers there did not go down this route of saying every game needs a D8, D12, D percentile right. die, and so on.
Does Japan not have dice factories?
I assume they do now. I think when TTRPGs were becoming popular there.
Got to import it.
You had to import it, and it was yeah. expensive. Yeah,
yeah. Squares.
Squares yeah. are great. And so these there were now there one place there were multi-sided, custom made dice that we talked about in our last time was these old school Prussian war games. Right.
Oh.
They had, because that was all custom, you know, bespoke dice for these princes or whoever to use. And so when David Wesley, this enthusiast of those old games, went to go track down, you know, D12s and D20s and so on, he bought them from like an Edmunds Scientific Supplies catalog, right? These are like a specialty expensive item. They were hard to get. There wasn't, yeah. It was one of those things where there wasn't a lot of demand for them. So there wasn't a lot of supply for them. And it was scarce and expensive. But they ended up in a lot of the games coming out of TSR, the studio that would go on to make D&D, right? And this included classic war games like Tractics, a terribly named game about World War II tank warfare.
Tractics?
Yeah, because
that sounds cool.
I apologize. It's about tank tactics,
mm-hmm.
and I guess track like treads. I think
I'm like thinking the tanks are like in vector shapes.
Oh, like 80s, like
line. I used to play a tank game that was like vector shapes like that. Or Star Fox.
Yeah. This is it's like World War II tank warfare tabletop role playing game. It is like it is to me quite a boomer concept. It's very like
boomers love their wars.
They love learning about wars. Yeah.
Yeah.
And look, Tractics does use a D20.
Mm-hmm.
It uses it in pretty unexciting ways. Like you have to roll above a 15 for a success. So it is using these like interestingly shaped dice, but it's not really thinking like what things can we do to make the probabilities of events modified by our actions, right? There's not, you know, advantage modifiers, things like that. But around the same time, TSR was also publishing Chainmail, which is like, it's kind of a war game simulator, but it's got like a lot more like Tolkien type stuff. There's hobbits and orcs and ents and balrogs.
Wait, there's really hobbits in it?
Oh my gosh, yeah. In these old TS, we'll talk a little bit more about this in our next flashlight.
I'm excited.
In these older games, they use a lot of the names that Tolkien either invented or popularized.
Right.
There were hobbits, there were ents, and there were, as a result, lawyers. And so they had to change the names. That's why hobbits are halflings now, for example. Ents are treants in the newer versions. It really had these Tolkien-esque monsters. And in Chainmail, even though it's not using the fun-shaped dice, you do see like modifiers to rolls, and like there's a required threshold to hit an enemy that can change with their attributes. And it's actually starting to look, you know, this is the mid-1970s, and it's already starting to look a lot like the types of modifiers that we would put on a roll now in most tabletop role-playing games. It is a little bit off topic, but Chainmail, which is kind of a precursor to Dungeons and Dragons in some ways, it uses a lot of these like fantasy trappings, these modifiers and so, on the dice and so on. One thing I thought was cool reading through the Chainmail rulebook in research for this episode, they completely sidestep the idea of good and evil. They're like, of course, there's no such thing in a fantasy world as good races and evil races. That's ridiculous. That's not the way that any world would work. Some societies are more lawful or chaotic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so goblins are chaotic, but they're not evil, right? And like elves are neither lawful nor chaotic. They're like somewhere in the middle. And it was kind of cool, because there was backsliding after that, right? And these games went into this world of like, no, inherently, innately evil people, which less satisfying world building and kind of a, I'm going to say, sadder way to look at the world. but way back in Chainmail, they already had this idea that like, no, there's lawful and chaotic, and that's an axis along which different actors in the world are separated, but they're not inherently like good or evil in that way.
Right.
I kind of like that. The original rule set also includes prices for a full multi-sided dice set.
Okay.
If you want to get the percentile dice as well, it comes out to $450 in dollars of that era, or about $20 now.
Okay. That's not bad.
It's not bad. Yeah, I mean,
that's like
I'm currently looking at a die that I spent substantially more than $20 on, this one D20.
Were they shiny and sparkly?
They weren't shiny and sparkly like this.
Okay, well, that's why you're paying a premium.
Riley, thank you so much for validating my dice purchase decisions. It means the world to me.
I mean, fun costs money.
Fun does cost money. We'll be talking more about that in subsequent weeks as well, as we get more to the business of these games.
Ooh.
But yeah, look, in Chainmail, they knew you'd be playing other TSR games that did require these multi-sided dice. Like, that was already becoming part of the norm, right? Anyway, by the time the first, like, rule sets for Dungeons & Dragons got published in the mid-1970s, it was just expected that you'd have a full complement of all the dice.
Mm-hmm.
And they loved their random tables. We've seen some of them. Magic users had a whole other tier of random tables. Control that weren't always that necessary. Control weather lasted for 4d12 hours. So you might control the weather for 4 hours or 2 days, depending on your dice roll, but probably somewhere in the middle. The spell Contact Other Planes had separate d100 tables for whether extraplanar entities could provide specific knowledge, whether your interpretation of that knowledge would be correct, and whether contacting extraplanar entities would cause what the devs called insanity. And, like, I don't know if all those things require separate D100 roles, but at the time, it was already 50 years ago part of the game that you would just roll a ton of dice, and you'd have all these different specialty shapes.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to spend, like, $5 on them, you got to roll them a bunch.
I mean, I roll them sometimes while we're recording, and I'm not supposed to. But as one problem that did arise, like, in the late 1970s, as Dungeons & Dragons became more popular, these dice were still kind of specialty items, right? Mm-hmm. And this game is taking off in popularity, probably in ways the creators didn't necessarily expect. And there was an acute shortage of all the specialty-shaped dice, which meant that TSR was shipping sets for where there was just little cardboard like chits, and you had to reach into a bag and draw a number because they didn't have enough dice to go around. So they were shipping with, like, hey, just draw from this little pile of cardboard chits, and we're also giving you a coupon to order dice when they do become available.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, the shape, like, as the game took off, a big part of it was mass production of D20s and all these specialty dice shapes ramped up with it. But of course, why else? Like, what other purpose is there for? I mean, they're nice to look at, but what other purpose is there for all these shapes other than gaming?
Other thing, paperweights, if they're big enough.
This one is pretty much a paperweight.
Yeah, well, this one. I got what? How many?
That's sides a D1. That's a D100 with 100 sides, and I think we've used it on the show before. It rolls forever.
It rolls forever.
And it's kind of hard to read.
It weighs like almost a pound.
Yep. I use it a lot in my main ongoing campaign for their like travel hazards tables.
Okay.
So there's 100 of those, and they roll that, and it knocks over everyone's drinks. It is great fun. Mm-hmm. Another aspect of like these classical games that have really survived all the way through to the modern era is like D&D specific monsters. And like, as we described previously, a lot of it is Tolkien inspired, right? Chainmail has orcs and Balrogs and stuff. But like right at the beginning of the game, TSR like invented a bunch of types of creatures that they persist right through to modern versions. Like a lot of these monsters show up in Baldur's Gate, like Baldur's Gate 3, or like the Chris Pine, Michelle Rodriguez D&D movie.
Yeah.
Like they invented these things in the 70s just that would be like fun flavor, and they've become like such a part of the aesthetic of Dungeons & Dragons, which I think is kind of cool. Typically, these monsters that they invented that weren't from pre-existing mythology or from Tolkien, they don't really make sense in universe. They're just kind of there. And they're just there to be fun.
Okay.
Like, their presence kind of signifies like, hey, you're playing Dungeons & Dragons. One of my favorites from this original like D&D era is the Nilbog, which is goblin backwards.
It's goblin spelled backwards.
It sure is. Rather than steal from the party, it compels the party to take treasures from it.
Okay.
And it heals when you damage it and takes damage from healing spells. Because it's like
that classic.
Yeah. Oh, it's fun. Yeah. And like, it doesn't make any sense how that monster would fit into any world, but like, it's kind of cool, and it feels very old school D&D.
Yeah. I mean, backwards world.
That's true. Ooh, my players might have to go to backwards world. Oh, they would quit the campaign so fast. But yeah, a lot of these old school monsters actually come from one specific source. Early D&D playtests used a pack of 99-cent plastic dinosaur toys from a company in Hong Kong as their little minis that they move around. These toys in this 99-cent pack were not particularly high quality. Some of the monsters ended up looking a little bit melty, and some of them were just full-on Ultraman monsters that had been mixed in with, like, mixed in this bag. This meant that Gary Gygax and a playtester named Tim Kask ended up looking through this like set of like bizarre minis, and then they like imagined what the monster would be. that you would encounter in a dungeon that would look like this, to rationalize these little things' inclusion in the game.
All right, yeah.
And I think this is a really fun concept.
Just work with what you got.
And, like, I mean, I think you would appreciate, like, that is a fun creative exercise, right?
Yeah.
Looking at pictures of these monsters and then trying to figure out, like, what you'd call them, what kind of environment they live in, and maybe how they would attack you.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm going to give you the opportunity to relive that. I'm going to put up on screen here a picture of one of those monsters, and I'm going to have you explain what you would call it, what environment it would live in, and what attacks it might have.
Okay.
Feeling ready?
I'm ready.
So there's our first monster.
Okay. He's a yellow guy, kind of rectangular shaped, a long beak.
We're going to post links to all these pictures in our show notes as well so that people can play along at home.
Yeah. Right now it's theater of the mind.
It really is.
He's got a kind of saggy belly, it looks like.
Yeah.
Probably it's hiding a tail back there.
There's definitely a tail behind there.
Yeah. Okay. And it looks like he has a mushroom hat on.
He's like, a cute little mushroom or leaf of some kind. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to go with he's going to be poisonous. That looks like a Mario mushroom, which is a psychedelic mushroom.
Ooh.
So his spit is his spit would be magic mushrooms.
Where does it live?
It lives, do they have pipes?
They absolutely have sewers in classic
sewers. D&D. Yeah. Yeah. He's going to live in the sewers.
Lives
I think.
In a sewer and spits poisonous hallucinogenic.
Yeah.
I love that. So this monster
name is Mushroom Murphy.
Mushroom Murphy. Fuck, that's so good. I'm actually going to start calling that monster the Mushroom Murphy whenever I run it. But this is, of course, the classic monster, the owl bear. It lives in the forest, and it has a moderately strong beak and claw attack.
Okay, owls.
Half owl, half bear.
Sure. That looks much more like some type of reptile.
Absolutely.
I don't know where the owl's coming from.
I don't see the owl either. Do you want to do a couple
okay,
more
Okay, Gary.
Okay, Gary.
Let's do another one, yeah.
What about this lovely creature?
Looks like a shrimp with four with four legs. Tail is...
Forked?
Forked, yeah. He's got long, like, those aren't whiskers or pinchers. There's just limbs sticking.
Like catfish whiskers.
Catfish whiskers. Yeah. Like shrimp, catfish mixed with legs. Looks like he's just evolved to go up onto land.
Yeah.
Also with beady eyes, also yellow mixed with red. Looks like that's just the
colors of plastic.
The color scheme. Yeah. Yeah. Kind of bumpy.
I guess what would you call it?
Bumpy shimp.
Bumpy shimp. Okay, I love it. What kind of attack does it do? How can this thing hurt you?
Looks like he's going to go like, bleh.
It's got a strong bleh vibe for sure.
Yeah. Is that psychic damage?
We can say psychic damage. Yeah.
We can say whatever we want, right?
Where do you think it would live?
It would live on the beach.
Hell yeah. I love this. So this is the classic D&D monster, the Rust Monster.
The Rust Monster.
The Rust Monster. It lives underground and it can corrode metal to eat it. It is actually kind of fun because it can destroy your weapons while you attack it.
Well, that sounds frustrating.
Old school D&D is all about frustrating players. Yeah. You want to do one last one?
Let's do it.
I love your interpretation of these. Bumpy Shimp is definitely a monster that I will incorporate into every future campaign. That's the owlbear again. What about this one?
Ooh. His body is pinecone shaped.
Yep.
His head is a cone kind of drill moment. He's got reptile like legs, some sharp teeth. I'm gonna go with Drill Boy.
Drill Boy, yeah. I mean, accurate.
Yeah. No, this guy lives in like caves and in rocks. Like,
how does he attack you?
Oh, he jumps at you. He jumps and he spins around in the air, and drills into you.
Hey, you nailed it.
Wait, really?
Yeah, this is, and you've actually seen me getting killed by one of these in Baldur's Gate on your couch. This is a Boulette. Ooh. It lives underground. It burrows around as a land shark.
Oh,
and
nice.
It can jump really far.
So oh,
you nailed okay. it. Yeah.
Okay, me and Gary on the same page with that one.
So yeah, like, and a lot of these monsters, they came up with then based on this one little pack of plastic toys. And we'll put a link to these pictures in the show notes. And they've just been baked into the lore. Like, there's owlbears in Baldur's Gate 3. And like, they've shown up in every edition and every adaptation of D&D ever since. So I think it's kind of cool.
That is cool.
And yeah, I mean, I feel like a lot of these decisions were being made, you know, for tactically at the small scale to make the game that they were playing in the moment interesting. But it's given us a lot of the flavor and a lot of the aesthetic we think of as tabletop role-playing games now, especially the dice. And I'm really excited over the rest of the season to zoom out from this small group of game devs to the broader history of Dungeons & Dragons.
All right.
That's all for this week.
I'm Production Master Riley.
And I'm Dungeon Inspector Jake.
If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and leave a review.
It helps other people find the show.
And will also ensure that your players actually chat up that mysterious stranger with an important plot hook.
For more on the show, including links to all our social media, visit foldedfrequencies.com/campaignspotlight.
Boom.
Honestly, I love your fucking world, Jared.